Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's only by a hair, but after a long, long run as the strong majority piece of the American pie, the middle class is no longer the great American majority. Numbers of rich have grown. Numbers of poor have grown. And now the middle class has slipped out of its majority status for this country. This is a big change. This hour on Point, middle-income America, where it went and whether and how it comes back. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you watched the middle class slide? What would bring it back? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today is Rakesh Kochhar, Associate Director at the Pew Research Center and author of the big new Pew study out last week, finding middle-income Americans no longer in the majority. You can link to the full report at our website, onpointradio.org. Rakesh Kochhar, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom.
So as I read you, you're saying the middle class is now basically just half, no longer more than half, just half of the country, and that is significantly down. How do you define middle class, middle income at this point, Rakesh?
In terms of just numbers, a middle income family is one living on about $42,000 to $126,000 annually. This is a family with three people, and it has income that is two-thirds to double the national median household income. Now, our definition of middle income does vary by household size. So if you have fewer people in the household, you need less income to be middle income. Mm-hmm. If you have more people in the household, the income range is bigger.
But essentially it's from two-thirds of the national median income to double the median income. That's a wide swath, but you call that these days, you call that middle income. And you find it right at 50%. In absolute numbers, you find it less than all the other categories combined. So, and no longer a majority. If we look back in time, we see this steady fall. What was the height of the middle class? What was the strongest portion that it comprised?
Right. Our data go back to 1970. So starting about 45 years ago, we find that 61% of American adults lived in middle-income households. And that has fallen steadily decade after decade. And today we have reached this milestone where the share is down to 50%. And as you noted, in terms of numbers, just a tad bit less than the share living in upper and lower income households.
So where have the rest of that change gone? Up, down? What do the higher class categories look like? They've grown, but so have the poorer.
Right. So the movement is in both directions. There is economic progress in the sense that the share of Americans living in upper income households has gone up. And in fact, this increase is greater than the increase in the share living in lower income households. But at this moment, you still have a greater share of adults living in lower income households. That's 29% compared with the share in upper income households, which is 21%. And then when we look deeper within the lower income and upper income groups, where is the change really happening? It is happening at the farthest edges of the distribution. Among the lower income groups, they are locating at the lowest end of the ladder. And among the upper income group, they are locating within the highest end of the economic ladder. So you're looking at what we call deeper polarization in the report.
So in 1971, your highest category included only 4% of Americans. And what does it take in terms of income to be in the highest category here?
In the very highest income category, that is more than three times the national median income. And today, that would be more than $188,000 for a family of three.
That was 4% of the country's population by your calculation in 1971. It has more than doubled to now 9%. In the terms that we hear of, you know, from the billionaire class these days, $188,000 still doesn't sound so terribly high. Is most of that growth right around there, or is it the tip, tip, tip top?
Well, we don't have fine enough data to break it down to the top 1% or 5%. So we are satisfied at the moment looking at the top 10%, perhaps, and likewise at the very low end.
So 1971, upper middle and highest income Americans together made up 14% of the country's population. Now you find them at 21%. So that has swelled. At the lower end, it was 25%, lower middle and low, or lowest as you call it, in 1971. That is now 29%, and with most of the growth there, all of the growth there, being in that very lowest category.
Right. All of the increase, the 4 percentage point increase, is at the lowest end of the income distribution. And today, for a 3-person family, that means living on less than $31,000 annually.
What does it mean for the country that this has happened, by your lights, Rakesh?
You know, I'm an economist, and sticking to economics is what I do. And so we're looking at economic polarization. We're looking at people who are farther apart than they used to be in their economic well-being. How this translates into other forms of polarization in society, I'm not sure, but possibly it does lead to other divisions as well.
Do you see anything on the horizon that would turn around this, what looks like a just unending descent of the middle class as a portion of the nation's population?
Well, I can only look backwards at what may have caused this, and this is a broader reflection of rising economic inequality in the country, driven by a number of factors ranging from changing needs for technical skills, more and more demand for workers with higher skills, trade, offshoring of jobs, decline of unions, and so on and so forth. So given these myriad factors, looking ahead, a possibly reversal in these factors may diminish the rise in economic inequality, create more job opportunities in the middle. But whether this happens or how it happens, I couldn't say.
I have to say, for somebody like me who grew up right through the heart of the strength of the middle class, it's very shocking to see. And we're going to dive on into the implications, how it might be turned around. Rakesh Kochhar is Associate Research Director at the Pew Research Center. Rakesh, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, welcome.
I want to go to New Haven, Connecticut right now, and Jacob Hacker, Professor of Political Science, Director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale, co-author with Paul Pearson of Winner Take All Politics and American Amnesia. Jacob Hacker, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What's it matter if the middle class makes up 50%, just slightly less than half in absolute numbers, versus 61%, which is what it was in 1971? What are the implications of that shift?
Well, I think it's a marker of how our society is changing, and I think it's a change that's going to have a big impact, already is having a big impact, on how Americans think about themselves and on our politics. So, you know, middle class wasn't just an income category in people's minds. It was a way of life. It was a way of thinking about the American dream. And when people looked at the United States relative to other rich democracies, especially European countries, what really stood out was the strength and size of our middle class and the degree to which Americans of relatively modest means, Americans who are working for a living, who didn't have large amounts of wealth, were nonetheless able to live lives that had been possible only for the richest in other countries before. And that included basic job security, workplace benefits, a secure retirement, the ability to own a home, to raise a family, and perhaps most important, the sense that things were moving toward an even better future, and that one would go up the economic ladder over time and that one's children would have the chance at a better life. So those are the pillars of the middle class. And as the middle class has shrunk in economic terms, I think we've also seen a diminishment of the faith in those ideals, or at least the sense that that middle-class Americans can achieve them.
You know, in the 1970s, I was living abroad a lot in countries where there was much less middle class than in the United States, and it struck me that there was such an ambient sense of insecurity there, less cooperation, maybe less idealism. I mean, it leaves me wondering now how much of the sort of attitudes of values and political interaction that we associate traditionally with the American way came from that very middle class bulk right there at the center of society.
Well, you know, it's a chicken and egg problem because, of course, those ideals are also what drove people to set out for the United States, from other countries, to seek out the frontier, to invest in their futures and build middle-class lives here at home. And so that there was a reinforcement between the ideals and the reality of middle-class life. And it's true that, you know, as early as the late 19th century, Europeans who looked at the United States just marveled at the degree of material well-being. And after the Great Depression and World War II, as the United States emerged as the preeminent world economic power, the United States really set a standard that other countries sought to emulate. And it's no surprise that, you know, the Cold War was waged over this picture of a kitchen, right? This idea of the ability to own a home, things that in European countries were really at the time out of reach. And so Americans were confident. They had a degree of trust in their government that they certainly don't have today. And they were optimistic about the future. They were willing to support political leaders who set out goals and visions that reflected a kind of faith that the United States would be a stronger nation in the country. And so to me, that, you know, that's the counterpart to the economic story that Rakesh was telling earlier, that we've really seen a body blow to this ideal of the middle class. And that goes well beyond the income statistics. It really includes the sense that there's just not the same chance that there once was of being able to achieve the American dream.
In a word, we're coming up on a break. In a word, does it have to be this way with global competition and changing technology?
In a word, no. Let's talk about that more.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this about the United States as no longer a majority middle-class country. New study out last week finds just 50%, and by absolute numbers, less than half of Americans now fall in what is being defined as the middle class. You can join us this hour. What does a shrunken middle class mean for this country, for the American dream, American politics, the future, and can this be turned around? Jacob Hacker is with us from New Haven, Connecticut, Yale University there. Elizabeth Jacobs and Tyler Cowen will join us in a few minutes. A lot of people talking about this on the campaign trail and right across the political spectrum. Different antidotes being proposed, but it's on everybody's lips. Here's, of course, Bernie Sanders.
The middle class of this country for the last 40 years has been disappearing. Millions of Americans are working longer hours for low wages, and yet almost all of the new income and wealth being created is going to the top 1%.
But it's not just Bernie Sanders. Here's Jeb Bush saying it's alarming.
The opportunity gap is the defining issue of our time. More Americans are stuck at their income levels than ever before. It's very hard for people to go from the bottom rungs of the economy to the top, or even to the middle. This should alarm you.
We are feeling alarmed. This is not news, really. We know that it's been happening, but once it hits, well, the Pew Center is calling it a tipping point, and it leaves everybody wondering where this goes. Jacob Hacker is with us from New Haven, Connecticut. Jacob, we've got a bunch of people calling, and then I want to get more of your thoughts here, but first, Dale in Columbia, South Carolina. Dale, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a concern about the definition that is used by the Pew Company, because I did read the article several days ago.
Yeah.
And I just feel that it's given way too broad a category, because I don't know what the definition now of the people that are in distress financially versus the the $46,000 middle class.
Too big a range being given or described as middle class here. Let us pick it up, Dale, and I appreciate your call. Jacob, we heard Rakesh at the Pew Research Center saying it's from two-thirds of the median household income to double the household income, which works out for a family of three from middle class. They're defining as all the way from $42,000 to $126,000. Is that a traditional – that's a pretty big span, but is it a traditional definition of the middle class?
Yeah, I think it's pretty close to the way that people look at this when they define middle class as income. But I think one way to broaden the caller's question, is to really ask, is the middle class, the idea of the middle class, really about income? And I think the answer is that it's a combination of things, as I was saying earlier, and at least income and wealth would be central to it. So I think one of the alarming features of what's happened over the last generation is that if you look beyond income, if you look to wealth, if you look to improvements in health over time, if you look to progress on educational attainment, the middle class is probably doing worse than it looks just from income alone.
What's happened with wealth, for example?
Well, so with wealth, we had an enormous hit to American housing wealth. But it's worth noting that even without that, the story has been of increasing concentration of wealth at the very, very top. For example, Thomas Piketty of Capital fame, the writer of that recent book, and some of his co-authors have looked at wealth over time, and they've found that about that most of that has really gone to, say, the top 0.1% or even the top 0.01% of the income distribution. So, but even more striking is just that wealth levels fell dramatically during the downturn, and so most Americans are feeling much, much less economically secure than they were 25 years ago. And so the thing that I would really focus in on is that the middle class as an ideal rested on this sense of confidence in the future and a degree of trust in government, that government actually had a crucial role to play in ensuring a prosperous middle class life. And that faith, as the middle class has shrunk, that faith has fallen away as well. And that's what's, I think, so volatile for our politics, because you have Bernie Sanders and Jeb Bush, and we haven't even mentioned him, Donald Trump, all talking about this issue, but they're all talking about it in very different ways. And in particular, if you look at Republicans talking about it, there's no sense that government could address the problem. And that's probably an accurate view of where a lot of people are right now, but it's not a view that is going to bring us to the kinds of discussions and policy solutions we're going to need. Because the middle class was constructed in the United States. It was a result of government policies. And, you know, from the GI Bill to the creation of the programs of economic security, like Social Security and Medicare, to the expansion of housing with government support, we saw government really play a vital role in constructing the American middle class and opening the doors of the middle class up to those who had been excluded, including most notably African Americans in the 1960s. So if we're not seeing government as a vital force for our economic progress, we're open to a lot of not just doubts about our politicians, but also some pretty ugly notions about where our problems come from.
Would that still work today, that kind of government intervention? I mean, I know you hear a lot. People say, well, the global competition has changed. America was the unchallenged economy at that time. Now you've got China and many other lower-wage countries. And you've got people always talk about changing technology and, you know, some people taking full advantage of it and ready to really work with it and others not. With those new developments, can government still pull it off, make it happen?
Well, our government's not working very well, so the answer is right now no. But I think that there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that this development has not occurred in all rich countries. Yes, other countries have seen growing inequality, but nothing like what the United States has had. And we've fallen behind a lot of these countries in terms of encouraging kids to graduate from high school and then college, in terms of improving health. So there's definitely a lot of space for us to improve. I mean, that's part of what one of the sort of positive side effects, if you will, of doing pretty poorly on many of these measures is we've got a lot of room for improvement.
Great, great. Once we were the improvement, now we have room for improvement. Jacob, more callers for you. Chris in Plattsburgh, New York. You're on the air with Jacob Hacker. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up, I saw the other night on the Blaze Network, Stu Bergier's program, that more people went up over the past several decades than went down to leave the middle class. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
That is true. And we heard Rakesh saying that from Pew before. What do you make of that, Chris?
Well, I think it's great. I'm 29 years old. I'm self-employed. And I want to go up. I want to have a larger family, be able to support them. It's just really important in my life. I think that one of the greatest problems that causes poverty is really psychosocial issues. At least what I've seen, I go into a lot of people's homes, but it's just a hard problem.
It's hard for sure.
Marriages that fail, it's hard.
I mean, there are a lot of hard angles here, but how do we make it work? Let's take that, Jacob Hacker. You know, the growth is stronger here in the upper and highest categories than in the lowest, though it grew in both. So you do have people who look at this and say, look, what's to moan about here? This is people moving up. Yes, others moving down, but people moving up, so let's celebrate.
Well, I mean, I think we should celebrate the increasing affluence of our country, but I don't think there's any dispute among economists who look at that the rewards of that growth have been very, very unevenly distributed, and that's probably not a great thing for our long-term economic growth. We're going to have Elizabeth Jacobs on later, and she works for an organization, the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, that has been looking at this for a while, and it used to be thought that growing inequality was potentially good for growth because it increased the incentives for people to strive to get up to the top. But there's just more and more evidence that people aren't as confident about the future. They're not as willing to invest, and our politics doesn't work as well when we have more inequality. So, and if you look at the statistics, I think we want to be careful because a lot of the upper middle group that's just mm-hmm. popped above that top level in Rakesh's discussion, those folks are living in high-cost urban areas. There's no regional cost of living adjustment in these figures that were produced. And so they're not going to be people that you would think of as particularly affluent. They're folks who, because of the rising cost of living in these areas and the rising cost of being middle class, right, in a country in which healthcare and education costs in particular have skyrocketed upwards, who are going to feel very, very squeezed. So I think it's a good thing we've seen increased affluence, but it's clearly the case that far too little of that has occurred in the middle, and there's a lot of evidence that the bottom is struggling as well, and that it would be struggling a lot more if we hadn't done a lot to try to help it over the last 25 years. So to me, this is a pretty clear picture. It was true before the downturn after 2008, and it's even more true today, and that, you know, if every politician is out there saying that things are awry, the real issue isn't whether there are problems. It's, you know, can we and how do we deal with them?
I know we're going to let you go, Jacob Hacker, but you look at this as you say this decline in the relative weight of the middle class goes right to this angst we feel so widely in the country today.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that the real challenge is going to be restoring some sense of faith that government can play an important role in helping us overcome these challenges. And there's reason to be optimistic, as I said, and not just because we're performing poorly, but because we've been learning a lot over the last 25 years about the costs of not investing in the middle class. And there are real calls to change course that are taking place, but they're not yet, unfortunately, really animating Americans who are very fearful and who are very skeptical of government. And unfortunately, I think there's just a huge divide among politicians, even those who agree there's a problem about what needs to be done. But hey, we're having the right conversation.
We're in it.
I think that's a big progress.
We're in it right here. Jacob Hacker at Yale, author of Winner Take All Politics. Thank you very much for being with us today, Jacob.
It's a real pleasure, Tom.
Everybody's talking. Thank you. Everybody's talking about it. Here's Hillary Clinton, end of October in Des Moines.
It's not enough just to rail against the Republicans or the billionaires. We actually have to win this election in order to rebuild the middle class and make a positive difference in people's lives.
And here's Ted Cruz all the way back in January after President Obama's State of the Union address.
We want a different path. We want robust economic growth. We want people to be able to achieve the American dream, and that's getting harder and harder right now because the facts are we're facing right now a divided America when it comes to the economy. It is true that the top 1% are doing great under Barack Obama. Today, the top 1% earn a higher share of our national income than any year since 1928.
True, and he pens it on Barack Obama. Of course, it's gone on longer than that. But even Ted Cruz talking about a divided economy right there. Let's bring in a couple of good thinkers to look at what might be done about this. Elizabeth Jacobs joins us from Washington, Senior Director for Policy and Academic Programs at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Elizabeth Jacobs, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
And from Fairfax, Virginia, Tyler Cowen joins us, economist, professor of economics at George Mason University, author of Average is Over and the Great Stagnation. Tyler Cowen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Tyler, does it have to be this way?
Keep in mind the context. Equality at the global level has never been higher. The world middle class is larger than ever before. I think what we're seeing is a transitional time where the American middle class is being squeezed. Yes, our growth is too low, but the broader picture is more optimistic than it looks. And if you consider a cleaner environment, more leisure time, greater safety, and greater tolerance, life here is getting better at a rate higher than those numbers indicate.
But is it a subject of concern to you that the middle class, as a portion of the American population, has shrunk?
It absolutely is. And a few things I would do. I would make it easier and cheaper to move into America's best cities. I would deregulate a lot of professions which are ruled by occupational licensing. And in general, I think our economy is too highly regulated and our growth has been slower since about 1973.
So you think it's an issue of overall growth. If growth were higher, the middle class would be bigger, or would we just see, I mean, people are starting to lose faith in that, Tyler. Many might think if the growth were higher, you'd just see more billionaires.
America is always going to be a less equal nation because we're a larger nation. We have larger markets. We export a lot to the world.
Hey, wait a minute. I want to stop it because we were not this unequal before. So I don't know how you can say America is always going to be less equal. We were way more equal. So how can you say that?
In 2015, you sell iPhones to China. That was not the case in 1963. We're never going to go back to that old world. We'll never have as much manufacturing employment again. But can we use today's technological innovations if we make our economy freer in the right ways? Keep in mind, government has never been spending as much on social welfare as it does now. Can we get back on the right track? I do think we can. But yes, it is a real problem.
Elizabeth, deregulate and push growth, and we will rebuild the middle class.
Well, I think there are a couple things here. I mean, first of all, we know that a strong middle class is key to a healthy, growing economy. We don't have to. There's not a trade-off. In the past, it's the middle class that has really driven economic growth, and we've got all kinds of data amassing to suggest that, you know, the hollowing out of the middle class is really at the expense of the rest of the economy as a whole. To the point of regulation, I think that if you look at what's been going on, you know, it's this hollowing out of the middle class has some trends going on underneath it that are kind of masked when you just look at family incomes. And the first one is earnings, right? We know that wage stagnation is a real problem. Wages have stagnated over this period, particularly male wages. I bring up gender because my second point is about what's happened with women's labor force participation over this period of time. And so what's going on in families in terms of even bringing in for those people who've managed to stay middle class, it's a completely different life than it used to look like in 1970. And so if deregulating everything isn't going to bring things back to where we were. I think we have to address what's going on in the labor market with wages and in families with the stress between, you know, you've got two earners coming in to make incomes pull together into that one family income. So that brings us to, you know, away from regulation and into something like looking at what's going on with wages. That means minimum wages, boosting the minimum wage. It means providing greater supports for families who are trying to juggle two careers in order to bring in the income that it takes to stay middle class. And that means all kinds of family support policies that we don't have in the U.S. And this, again, kind of links back to something that Jacob was talking about earlier in the hour in terms of what's happened in other countries and how they've addressed the same economic pressures that Tyler's talking about. We've seen the same global pressures all over the world, right? The U.S. isn't the only place that's faced open markets and dealt with the rise of China. But we're the only country that's seen the kind of dramatic hollowing out. And that's because we have very different social policies in place. And it's not just about the regulation piece.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about the United States as a no longer majority middle class country. Pew Research Center out with a new report saying it is now just less than all the other categories combined. The poorest, the poorer, the lower middle income, the upper middle, the higher. Put those together, they now outnumber the middle class in this country for the first time in a very, very long time. This is a change in the American profile. We've seen it happening, but now the Pew Research Center calls this a tipping point in our economic history. You can join us today. What do you see happening with the middle class? How would you change it? Here's Nathaniel Boone. He was in the Marines after the Second World War, part of that generation. He joined because he wanted to use the GI Bill to get to college. He saw that as his only way out of poverty. Now, in his later years, here he was talking with CBS in 2014.
I don't know what I would have done if the GI Bill had not been there. It established the middle class of people in the United States, because in those days, you were either rich or you were poor.
And then for a long time, middle class membership defined this country. Now, that at a tipping point, says Pew, and people worried about it. Here's Meredith Riley, 37-year-old social worker in New Jersey, single mother of two, lost her job in the recession, which paid about $50,000 a year. Here she was talking with CBS News last week about the three jobs she now has to hold things together and her view of the future.
I think the toughest part is not preparing a future for my children that my parents prepared for me.
Elizabeth Jacobs, what about our ex-Marine there talking about how important the GI Bill was for him? We heard Jacob Hacker say, look, the middle class in this country was deliberately built by government policy. Do you agree?
I do agree. I mean, I think that's a great example, and it's always really touching to hear from people firsthand who make that connection in their lives, because it's true, as Jacob pointed out. And one of the things that really stood out for me about the recent Pew study is how well older Americans have done, particularly relative to other age groups. And as Pew notes, one of the reasons that this has happened is because we've made a major investment in protecting the economic lives of older Americans through the Social Security program, which is a phenomenal success. So we're capable as a country of putting together programs that ensure people's economic well-being, and we've seen the benefits of doing that for generations past. The question is whether we're capable of actually doing it again. And, you know, I think we are, but we've certainly got a lot to do with our politics to kind of get things back in a place where we can actually get some things done.
Tyler Cowen, looking at people responding online here, Lisa sees a bright future coming up, says, we have yet to imagine how the middle class will develop in a knowledge economy and technology. It will be amazing. Maybe, but I think a lot of people are waiting for that to be the case. Not so far in terms of the middle class anyway. Roger says we need another FDR and resurgent Democratic Party. Destroy conservative ideology that creates poverty in reality. What about the government role? What about technology coming to our rescue at some point rather than the opposite, Tyler?
We have a skills problem. We have a productivity problem. More and more jobs are tech jobs or are becoming tech jobs, and we're not training people to do that kind of work. We're not doing what we once did with the GI Bill. One boon we'll get for the future is simply having a whole generation growing up being familiar with the internet and information technology. But I don't think the answer is redistribution. Yes, that can help some individuals, but to get sustainable gains and to pay for all of this, we need higher productivity, better education, and a better matching of skills and jobs. That, to me, is really a key looking forward.
Elizabeth, productivity and education is the keys. How do you see those?
Well, I mean, I think obviously productivity and education are super important, right? Human capital is part of how we grow the economy by having high-skilled individuals. But we also know that inequality has grown even amongst college-educated individuals. And so we can't just say that the solution is making sure that everyone goes to college, everyone gets a credential. We have to be really thinking hard about matching, you know, our skills pipeline with what we need for the future. And it's very hard to make predictions that way, right? The thing economists do worse is predict the future. So I certainly agree with Tyler that we need to be making investments in education, but I think that doesn't stop us from thinking about the implications of the big spread in terms of inequality and the real-term implications that might have for now. I'd also note that, I mean, part of where we're going to get the money that we need for paying for these social programs is by looking at the dramatic spread in income inequality, by taking a look at what's happening at the very, very tippity top, right? We know that in the last couple decades, the vast majority of gains from the growth that we've seen in our economy as a whole have gone to the very top 1%. So that's not the middle class. That's not the upper middle class. That's the really tippity top. And so there's a lot of kind of surplus going on up there, and particularly surplus that's going on that people may not have gotten just because of skill or hard work, but because with having a huge amount of income and power comes the ability to kind of rig the rules of the game in ways that are potentially depressing wages for everyone else. So while skills and education are certainly important. I think it's kind of a little bit naive to just stop there in terms of solutions, because we haven't seen that work particularly well for us over the last several decades as a strategy.
Tyler, the tip-top has done fabulously well. There's no arguing with that. Do you look at tapping some of that accumulated wealth and income to help retool the rest of society as redistribution? Is that something you'd stay away from?
Well, let's keep in mind, measured rates of social mobility have not fallen since 1970. So there's a lot of talk of inequality, but I don't find inequality objectionable per se. If Mark Zuckerberg is wealthy because he created Facebook, I say that's wonderful. And furthermore, he's going to give virtually all of that money away. When you look at what rate are people rising from the bottom to the top, according to research by Raj Chetty, that actually has not been going down.
But our middle class is smaller, and everybody's worried about the health of the economy, for that matter, these days, of the society overall. So Elizabeth says, tap that money that has accumulated fabulously at the top to help fix the problems. What do you say, Tyler?
We're an aging society. The problem with the federal budget is we have already pledged that money to the elderly in terms of accumulated obligations to Medicare, Social Security. So the idea that there's this big pot of money out there that we can spend on whatever ideas we might have to make the world better, it's actually not that true. We'll have a hard time making ends meet given the budgetary pledges we've already made.
You're saying you're expecting higher taxes on the rich just to pay for Social Security?
Absolutely. And virtually all economists would agree with that. Most of all Medicare, but Social Security too.
Elizabeth, it's already spoken for, is the case made there. What do you say?
Well, and I would argue there's probably more, and I would argue the reason to think about it is just going back to this idea of how the top affects the rest of the distribution, right? There are good reasons to think that one of the reasons why wages might have stagnated at the middle, one of the reasons why the middle class may not be doing as well, is because the top is pulled so far away. And that's really an open area of research. That's a question. It's an open question for me, but I think it's a really important one to answer because it kind of changes the sense of urgency about how we think about the importance of what it means to be a member of American society, right? Like, and where our resources come from. So Tyler's certainly right. We have an aging society, the demographic issues that creates and the strains that create on the existing revenue streams is certainly real. But we also know that the amount of money that's coming to the top, potentially at the expense of everyone else, I think means that we can be more optimistic about the resources available to us than some might like to suggest.
Let's go to our listeners. Mikayla in Austin, Texas. Mikayla, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering, how much is the shareholder economy hurting the middle class, and how does shareholder influence now compare with decades before when the middle class was booming?
I'll take it to Tyler Cowen first. Tyler, you know, of course, shareholder was put front and center in a very, very strong way, starting in the, 70s, really in the 80s, and we've seen a lot of fallout from that. Has that taken our eye off the ball of the wider population?
I don't think that's the main problem for the middle class. One problem is a lot of the new jobs require technical skills, which people don't have. Another problem is just competition from so much labor elsewhere in the global economy. And then a lot of our own sectors have had fairly low productivity. If you put together those three explanations, I think that accounts for at least three quarters of the problem.
But maybe we'd have a lot of jobs that wouldn't be shut down if you didn't have to maximize at every moment for shareholders. And out of that mentality also, we see compensation for CEOs just absolutely skyrocketing in those years. That hardly looks like a boost to middle income prospects.
I don't think there's any feasible way of stopping American capital from investing abroad, and by the way, making much poorer nations than we are much wealthier and making this a better world. The long-run key to succeeding is to build up our skills so the people who are lagging behind can once again be ahead.
Build the skills. We'll look at that again, but Elizabeth, shareholders first. That mentality, important in terms of what's happened with income distribution in this country or not?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, we know that the vast majority of the sort of stretching out of the economic distribution has happened at the very top. It's easy to lose sight of that a little bit based on the Pew study, which is focused on the middle class, which is hugely important. But a lot of the action that Pew can't get at because of the data they're using is happening at the very, very top. So they find some polarization, and the polarization it's stretching up into the top, but they can't say whether it's in the tippity top or just kind of generally the top. And the reason that's important is that that suggests that some of what's going on isn't just about these skills issues that Tyler is talking about, which are obviously important. It suggests that there's something else going on. And I think the financialization revolution and the shareholderization piece is a big kind of clue. And this is a very live field of research in economics. I don't think we know completely what's going on, but there's some kind of telling clues suggesting that this might be part of where the mystery is going to be unraveled.
Tyler says build skills above all, and having a skilled workforce by any measure is a fantastic thing. Is that where you put your number one focus here? Can we do that and everything else is solved? Or is there something else in terms of the way we structure policy that, in addition to skills, is required to actually make the wealth shared?
I think there's certainly something in addition to skills. That's not where I would start. It would be part of the solution, certainly. I think all of us have certainly gotten a great deal of value from the education and skills that we've accumulated, so it would be pretty disingenuous to suggest that skills don't belong on the table. But I do think that there are plenty of very skilled people who are still struggling. You know, as I said earlier, we know that college-educated individuals haven't gained ground over time. They've sort of treaded water. But it hasn't helped people get ahead, which suggests that this isn't just about skills. It's about something bigger going on in the economy, which is part of where the financialization and the shareholder picture comes in, of kind of dynamics changing at the top in ways that are potentially disadvantaging or even, kind of taking advantage of people in the middle at the bottom in order to enhance people at the top. And that's just fundamentally not how the American economy works. And it's not healthy for American economic growth. We've talked about how the middle class in the past has been the source of strong growth for this country. And I think we know at this point there are a fair number of clues suggesting that if we want to kind of tap into healthy growth in the future, we've got to figure out how to fix this so that growth isn't just going to those people at the tippity top, but is actually, spread more equitably across the distribution.
Alex in Providence, Rhode Island. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see, Alex?
I'm wondering what your guests think about the possibility that middle-class complacency could have an impact on what we've seen over the last few decades. And what I mean by that is the possibility that people became comfortable with the status quo, the way things were. Lost a sense of striving and adapting to new technology and changes in the economy, and then as a result, fell out of the middle class.
So what, you're picturing a middle class kind of fat and happy and just not motivated?
No, I would say that my thinking would be that that would be a part of it, not all of it. And I don't mean to imply that people would be sitting around fat and happy, but I think a lot of people know... I think that someone like Donald Trump appeals to the sort of resentful person who didn't go to college and seek out a different career than what was than what they had been doing for a long time, and now it seems that seems to be an easy target for people who want to appeal to kind of middle class resentment.
Yeah, Alex, let us pick it up. Tyler Cowen, a lost sense of striving. Alex says, do you see it?
I don't want to make that the main problem, but I do think it's a problem. If you look, say, at the incomes of Korean Americans or people who have come from India, they're doing very well. And that gives us a clue. If you have the right skills and are, working with the right culture, there still is a lot of opportunity in today's world.
Nathan in Hartford, Connecticut. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
So myself, I am a STEM graduate, college computer science, and my best friend is a mathematics graduate. And we're both in the millennial generation, graduated in 2010, and we're both seeing our wages stuck at about $13.50 an hour, and we just don't have any bargaining power. So I'm wondering what your speakers have to say about the future for millennials.
So how does it make you feel when you hear Tyler say, build skills and you'll be fine? How does that strike you, Nathan?
I had to work through college in order to pay for it. I have about 10 years of computer science skills. I'm a front-end developer, and I find that kind of difficult because there has been a lot of opportunity in computer science.
Yeah. Elizabeth Jacobs, what do you say to that? There's Nathan. He has built skills, and he can't get out of that $13.50 an hour trap.
Yeah, I think I hear that story a lot, and I wish him the best of luck. I hope you land on your feet. I'm somehow sure you will. But I think skills especially in a rapidly evolving, technologically advanced economy where we are right now, you can develop skills, but they become obsolete, right? And so figuring out how to create a society where we can help people reskill or upskill, there's lots of different names for it. I think that's part of what we need to do. And so this is, you know, on the one hand, a kind of a nod to the emphasis that Tyler's put on skills and education, but it's also suggesting that there's something bigger there in terms of helping, having a society that actually helps people make transitions in a world that's transitioning in some ways much more rapidly than we've ever experienced before. And I don't think we do that particularly well. And some of the problems created for our politics that I think stem directly from some of this inequality make it even more difficult for the political system to create institutions that help individuals respond at the pace that they need to. So that, I guess, would be kind of the big picture.
If we don't turn this around and restore the middle class, what worries you, Elizabeth?
I worry most for our politics, right? I mean, as Jacob started the hour with talking about the power of the American government to really support a middle class and support an American economy that was the pride of the world, I worry that if we don't really take this seriously, we're not going to be able to solve problems and sort of shine in the way that we have in the past.
Because we won't have enough shared interests, enough strength in the center?
Precisely.
That's it for this conversation on the middle class, but this is an issue that's just around and surely back around. No longer the majority of the U.S. population. Elizabeth Jacobs is Senior Director at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth for Policy and Programs there. Elizabeth Jacobs, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And Tyler Cowan, author of Average, is over at the Mercatus Center, George Mason University. Tyler, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.